Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're starting our show today by taking a look at Wisconsin's large wild bird population and a study that reveals how we can maybe better protect our hawks, our owls, our eagles, and a whole lot more. A couple of guests for you today. Tom Hauge co-chairs the Wisconsin's Green Fire Wildlife Work Group. It's part of the Science Advisory Council. He retired from the DNR Management Program, where he spent 24 years as the program director. And Tom, you were on this show quite a few times over the years. Great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
With us as well, Carrie Behiller. Carrie is a member of Wisconsin's Green Fire Science Advisory Council and has experience, of course, with wildlife and veterinary health pathology and diagnostic investigations. Carrie served as a wildlife health specialist with the DNR. And Carrie, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. Full disclosure, when I was with the Wisconsin DNR, Tom Hauge was my boss.
Oh, he's no longer your boss.
And we're still working together quite well.
We're working through that, Larry.
Well, it's great to have you both here. And as you listen to our two experts talk, as you listen in, I hope you'll join in. Tell us why large birds matter to you. Do you have... you live next to an eagle nest, or maybe you watch loons on the lake near your home. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Curry, today we're going to be talking about these large, wild, non-hunted birds, and I mentioned a few of them, but maybe you can give us some examples of the birds that were part of your study, for example.
Right. The key, I think, is that they are the non-hunted birds. You know, so the birds that we have included in our phase one report are those that do have no hunting seasons on them. And these includes water birds such as common loons, white pelicans, tundra swans, trumpeter swans, sandhill cranes. Those are mostly the water birds. And then we have categories that we call the raptors, the hawks and the owls and eagles. Those would be bald eagles, red-tailed hawks, great horned owls, rough-legged hawks, osprey and merlin. Those are smaller hawks, and then also the great horned owls and the barred owls.
So lots of birds. As you think about those birds, what role do they play in our ecosystem? I got to maybe even ask both of you that, but go ahead, Carrie.
These are predatory birds, the hawks and the owls and the eagles, and they are very important to the balance of the ecosystem. Turkey vultures are another one that we found were shot quite a few high numbers. And turkey vultures are, you know, like the cleanup experts of the ecosystem. I mean, they are just fantastic in terms of taking care of, you know, dead animals on the landscape. The other ones, you know, the water birds, those are very important in terms of just being functioning part and beautiful birds in the ecosystem. I mean, who doesn't love to see a swan?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're both members of Wisconsin's Green Fire. So, and Tom, maybe go to you. Tell us more about the organization itself.
Sure. The Wisconsin's Green Fire is pretty new on the block still. We formed in 2017. And I think our current membership is just a little bit north of 800-some members across the state. Our mission, basically, is to promote science-based management of the natural resources. And that's probably the reason we formed it. We were concerned back in 2017 that maybe science was being ignored a little bit too much in the policy-making decisions that were happening. So that was kind of our genesis. We have a small staff. We have an executive director, Melissa Johnson, and a few other staff members that help with the getting the word out on the work that we do, as well as working to keep us connected with the decision makers around the state so that we can bring the science to them. So our members are located all across the state, and one of our strong suits as an organization is that many of our members spent their entire career in natural resources management and a lot of different disciplines. Carrie and I have a wildlife background, and she has the wildlife health expertise. But we have people that spent their years working on air quality or water quality, all kinds of different aspects of natural resources management. So that's a little bit about Wisconsin's Green Fire.
That's pretty cool. And do you have to be, to have that kind of background to be a member?
No. I think our only prerequisite is that you are someone who supports using science in forming the policies for the sound management policies for our natural resources. Don't have to have a background. All we care is that you care, I guess, basically, yeah, about, right, our natural resources.
The only thing, exactly, Tom, the only thing I would add to that is Green Fire is a team. We are a really good functioning team of conservation science experts. Right now, we are doing some fundraising for scholarships and to further our research efforts. So go to our website, wigreenfire.org, for more information.
Yeah, we've got that up on my page today, too, on the
Thank
Larry
you.
Mueller Show page. So there's a link there. Well, the DNR has responsibility, or sort of the legal responsibility or what have you, of collecting information about large bird mortalities. And this is something beyond, although I'm sure the DNR is happy to have you doing this work. Certainly, it may be about beyond their scope. But what's the need for the future research on the death of large wild birds?
Well, currently, there is no consistent database. And that, I think, is, you know, for me, that's one of the primary factors. Wildlife rehabilitation in Wisconsin is a licensed activity by the Wisconsin DNR, and all the wildlife rehabilitators have to complete an annual report. So for every year, mm-hmm, at the end of the year, they complete, you know, what they have for intakes and what happened to those animals they brought in. But everyone has a different reporting system, so we have no consistency in the database. So to go through that data and find out how many loons were shot, how many pelicans had lead poisoning, for example, is a very tedious effort at this point. And so DNR would like to have a consistent statewide database, and they are very supportive of Green Fire and our efforts to continue that. So that's one of the main research things that we're working on right now.
And I would add, Larry, so when we think about natural mortality in wild animals, We only know what we can see or what we can detect.
Yeah.
So for so many species, we don't know all the causes of their mortality.
Sure.
Basically, the mortality causes that we're talking about in terms of this study, we're learning about as a result of animals who found their way. Not that the animals found their way, but people found them and then brought them to the wildlife rehabilitators in the state. And those are, think of them as an emergency room for wildlife.
Yeah.
They brought the animal in and diagnosed what was wrong with it. Was it shot? Is it having lead poisoning issues or some other mortality factor?
And they do, they actually, as an aside, they do a wonderful job. And they're not, they receive no government financial support, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And they provide an incredible community service. I mean, the wildlife rehabilitators are doing this work completely unfunded, state or federal funds. And so that's another thing that Green Fire can help with, trying to secure funding for those very needed activities.
Mary in South Range, by the way, couldn't stay with us, but wonders, could you explain the origin of your title, Wisconsin's Green Fire?
Well, that was a question I wasn't really expecting. It's obvious since we live in Wisconsin, there is a connection to Aldo Leopold and his passage in the Sand County Almanac book about the green fire in the eyes of the wolf that he witnessed dying.
Yeah.
I think we think of it more from the standpoint that there is a fire in Wisconsin to conserve and properly manage our natural resources. And that's the green fire that we're speaking about. We're not officially linked to the Elda Leopold Foundation or Elda Leopold, but obviously we draw our inspiration from him.
Yeah, very well put. Records you uncover now. You work with the wildlife rehabilitators, and I'm pretty sure they're good at keeping records. Carrie.
Yes, they are, and I just want to point out too, Larry, that all of these records that we included in our study were voluntarily given to us. The wildlife rehabilitators were very appreciative of the fact that, as a science-based organization, we could delve into the data and look at it objectively and make some collaborative decisions about what was happening. And so all of this information was given to us voluntarily.
And it had to be some funding involved in this, I would guess.
The original funding was from the James E. Dutton Foundation, and that was in 2022, I believe. And that was $5,000. And that was used, you know, very appreciated and used well. And now we're going to embark on phase two. This is phase one. This published report is phase one. We want to embark on phase two. And for that, we are doing some fundraising, as I mentioned, right now. We have a seed fund, if you will, of $2,000 from the Brogan Foundation. And so that's how we're going to embark on phase two.
And it doesn't seem like a lot of money, but I'm pretty sure there's a lot of volunteer work among the Greenfire folks to really carry it all out.
Yeah, we're all unpaid volunteers, and my wife can attest to that. We spend a lot of hours doing this kind of thing. But if you're going to take on a study like this, you probably need to hire, maybe it's a graduate student or somebody like that, and they're going to need a salary. The actual cost of the manipulation of the data is probably all that isn't all that much, but it's primarily just going to be the time of somebody to build the data sets and then wade through it.
Right. And one thing that DNR law enforcement is very happy with this, because they can use this for prosecution, if you will. They can, you know, if we mm-hmm. have this data entered, they can pinpoint where these occurrences are happening, and that will help prosecute violators.
Yeah. Louise in Dodgeville has a question about vultures, I think. Louise, go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering about what kind of vultures we have in Wisconsin. We had an opossum unfortunately get hit by a car and then fell into our property. So then we watched as the vultures, there was two of them, they were able to dispose of the carcass in like 2 days at the most. So I just was curious about what kind of vultures we have and if they are threatened at all. And I can take my answer off the air.
All right. Carrie, you want to?
Thanks for your question, Louise. Turkey vultures are the ones that we have in Wisconsin, and they are fabulous. They are fabulous ecosystem scavengers, and they clean up everything, as you well noticed. Turkey vultures, the ones with the red heads are the adults, and the ones with the black heads are the youngsters. And turkey vultures tend to nest on, if you're in the Dodgeville area, they tend to nest on cliffs. And so like some of those beautiful cliffs that are all around Governor Dodge, for example, those are prime turkey vulture nest sites. Unfortunately, what we found that the turkey vultures in the 5 years we looked at the data, 7 of those birds were shot out of 51 that were submitted. So turkey vultures, unfortunately, seem to be a species that people see flying and they just decide that they're going to shoot them. And they're wonderful, wonderful birds.
Yeah.
The data that we have in this report on turkey vultures is going to be cited in the upcoming Cornell Birds of the World volume. So that's very useful information as well.
That's great. And your study really was focused primarily for this, if I'm not mistaken, on birds that were shot.
That's kind of what got us into this effort in the first place, Larry. We were contacted by some members of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Council or network. In fact, Marge Gibson up at Antigo, you may know her.
I've interviewed Marge a number of times.
Yes, she's fabulous, and her organization is fabulous. But Marge and a number of other rehabilitators had observed what they felt was an uptick in illegal activity, and they were concerned about it, and they reached out to us for whatever assistance that we could provide. Being kind of the data nerds that we are, we said, well, let's see if we can document a trend, because if we're going to go out and speak about it, it'd be helpful to have the baseline data if we inform decision makers or other folks that we need to take action on these problems. And so that's kind of what got us into this in the first place.
Yeah. And I imagine you kept data on, or maybe you have it but haven't just all analyzed it, on other ways that the birds from the rehab centers were affected by one thing or another.
Exactly. We have that information, and as I said, it's very messy right now. There's no consistency in terms of the data set. So it's not quantitative at this point. The semi-quantitative is what we have published here, but the other causes of mortality in the birds that came to the wildlife rehabilitators, for example, are trauma from collision with stationary objects such as windows or moving objects such as, you know, semi-trucks, lead poisoning, as we mentioned, anticoagulant rodenticide poisoning is also a big one. When the hawks or the owls eat, you know, a rat, for example, that's consumed some of that, secondary poisoning occurs in those raptors. Other causes of mortality are avian influenza, West Nile virus. And so those are the kind of things that we want to pull out of these data sets and have that database so we can have quantitative information.
We are talking to Carrie Behiller, who's a member of the Wisconsin's Green Fire Science Advisory Council. I'm with Tom Hauge. Tom is co-chairs Wisconsin's Green Fire Wildlife Work Group. You can join in with your questions or comments. Number to call is 800-642-1234. You can email us to ideas@WPR.org. And Mary Kay and Kenosha, we'll get to you in just a minute, but there's a line open for you, so give us a call. I'm Larry Mealer for Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mealer here. We're talking about some research that will hopefully help protect our large wild birds in our state of Wisconsin with our two guests, Carrie Behiller, who is with Wisconsin Green Fires Science Advisory Council. Tom Hauge also co-chairs Wisconsin's Green Fire Wildlife Work Group. So, Mary Kay and Kenosha, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. What's on my mind, Larry, is the DNR and the city and the county's parks departments and the Conservation Congress needs to have meetings once in a while about the pesticide use they're using in the parks, because some have no creatures in them at all, maybe have a few sparrows, and mad cow disease, to discuss those two issues.
Well, I don't think we can discuss mad cow disease, but I think pesticides, herbicides may have come up in your research looking into those animals that were taken off to the wildlife rehab centers.
Yes, I can answer that briefly. The birds that are found, birds and mammals that are found ill and are taken to wildlife rehabilitators, you know, there's a lot of, essentially, as Tom mentioned, it's like an emergency room, you know, for the creatures.
Sure.
And so the rehabbers have to use their best judgment and their training in terms of determining what kind of clinical signs these animals are showing, like what possibly could be making them sick. And it's what we call a differential diagnosis. Like you start with the simplest, you know, and then you go down the list. And as you go down the list to test for pesticides and herbicides, those tests are quite expensive. And the rehabbers, remember, they're not getting any kind of funding, state or federal. And so a lot of times what they'll do is just take care of the animal best they can, supportive care, and then, you know, collect samples and archive, save those samples, if you will, so that whenever funding does become available, they can actually test those samples to find out what the compound is. But their main objective is going to be to make sure to keep that animal healthy and to not have it suffer.
Yeah.
One thing I would add to that is I do believe, excuse me, within the public parks and management arena that they are becoming more aware about turf management practices, things that would apply a pesticide or an insecticide or something like that on the ground, and watching, excuse me, trying to do that in a way that will be least harmful to unintended purposes.
We have, looking at this study, and I just did want to mention, I mean, there were 11 eagles shot out of a total of 600 or so that were brought in, which is an amazingly large number of animals to wind eagles to wind up at the rehab center. And the most often shot bird was a red-tailed hawk, which, I, as I said before the show today, before we were on the air, it doesn't surprise me much because there are the large numbers of them, and they tend to be in areas that are quite accessible.
Yes, unfortunately, yes. Red-tailed hawks, 16. So what we did with this data set, some rehab centers gave us information for 12 years, and some gave us information for, you know, 5 years. And so what I did as the primary investigator was to kind of narrow down what was what would be consistent and reliable data. So we chose four centers, rehab centers from different parts of the state that had consistent reporting data for a 5-year time period. And so with that 5-year time period, 16 red-tailed hawks were shot. More than one red-tailed hawk every year. That accounts for 4% of the birds that we included in the data set, which is very unfortunate.
Warner in Green Valley, Arizona, will go to you now. Hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. I've just recently heard about this organization, and I'm wondering if they do things other than what's being described on the air. Is this a broad spectrum organization, or is it just limited to things like wildlife?
Well, thanks for that question. We are definitely a broad-based organization. We have published a number of, I'll call them white papers on subjects, I think, of pretty widespread interest here in Wisconsin. I think we hear a lot about PFAS these days, and PFAS in our drinking water, and what are they and where are they found? We've published papers on that. We have published papers on Wisconsin's timber wolf population. Carrie and another one of our members published a paper looking at a 21st century energy policy for our state. We are. We also engaged with Monroe County to develop, I guess, a readiness report. Are they ready for climate change impacts in their state? We have published on deer management, chronic wasting disease. So I guess the answer to the question, we cover the gamut. If it's natural resources, we're interested.
Yeah.
Science-based conservation.
Yeah. Warner, does that help out?
I think it does. How can we support the effort?
Yeah, go ahead, Carrie.
You can find out more information if you go to our website. wigreenfire.org. And as Larry has mentioned, he has it up on his page today, so you can check that out. There's a number of different useful categories on this well-organized website. So anything you want to look into, just click your mouse and you'll get right to that.
So it's wigreenfire.org, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
Werner, thanks a lot for calling. Let's see. We have Joel in Fond du Lac. Joel, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an observation and then a question. My observation is I've been an avid bow hunter for deer for 50 years in Wisconsin. And when I was a kid, just starting out, we never ran into sandhill cranes. Now they're very common, and they have actually, they have a tendency to spot a man in a tree stand, and they'll yell out a warning to each other and possibly the deer on the ground. And the deer, yes, it's true, and the deer on the ground have adapted to where when I was a young man, deer never looked up. That's why we were in tree stands. Now, when the sandhill cranes snitch us out, they look around for us up in the tree stand. So, that being said, since there's these tattletales, the sandhill crane out there, and they are kind of a bane of us deer hunters, I'm wondering how many do you run into of them being shot? And on a secondary note, are they natural? I mean, were they always in Wisconsin and DDT kind of wiped them out and they did a comeback? Or are they kind of like an invader?
Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
I'll start with the second part of your question. They are part of the original complement of wildlife species here in our state. And their demise probably came as a result of large-scale wetland drainage, unregulated hunting practices. Those two in combination drove that original population down to almost extirpation in our state. And so it's a remarkable restoration story for sandhill cranes. And Kerry can deal with your question with regards to how many might have been illegally shot.
Right. Sandhill cranes are smart. So, yeah, I didn't know that about them being the tattletales to the bow hunters. So, but I can tell you from the data we looked at for those five-year time periods, we had sandhill cranes were shot in 4 of the 5 years that we evaluated. And that's 6 out of 56 sandhill cranes that were submitted. You have to remember, too, that, as Tom mentioned, we and the wildlife rehabilitators are not getting every animal or every
right.
bird that's illegally shot. I mean, these are the birds that were brought in injured to the wildlife rehabilitators. So there may be many more than that.
And some that just died right on the spot when they were shot. Well, you know, your study includes recommendations to hopefully decrease the shooting of non-hunted birds, large birds. So that's sort of the goal in the end. I mean, the goal is to find out all these various, and we haven't even talked about all of the other potential reasons why the birds get sick. But
yeah, we're really getting just started on this whole project. I believe Kerry refers to this phase one report as sort of our proof of concept that can we mine this data from the rehabilitators to give us some, to point us in some directions that would help with the conservation of these species. And I think the phase one report is a resounding success, indicating that is possible. So now we're looking to cast the net wider and get as much of the rehabilitator data as we can, get it standardized. That's not going to be any small project. But so there's a phase two project that's being prepared, and we are starting to solicit money for it. But coming out of that will certainly be some recommendations that hopefully will help address some of the problems that we're seeing. from on the law enforcement in terms of these illegal shootings. There's not a conservation warden behind every tree in the state of Wisconsin.
Right.
And so when an illegal shooting takes place, oftentimes it's somebody may come across the animal a day or so after the incident occurred. And then for the local conservation warden to try to piece together the whodunit part of it is very, very difficult. And sometimes it might take couple of years, maybe,
sure.
if they ever are able to track down what happened. So one of the things that I think we hope comes out of this is just the education process is that, number one, it is not okay to shoot these species. And number two, if you see something, say something. Because that's the way our conservation wardens can be more effective. And I know another aspect of this too is the lead poisoning part of the mortality that comes through, and there it's a relatively, thank God, there's a technological fix. If we can stop using lead-based ammunition and sinkers, we'll do a lot to curb the mortality that's caused by those two things.
Yes, exactly. Tom is exactly correct in those statements. In terms of the outreach and public education, I mean, that's kind of paramount to what we want to do. And so thank you, Larry, for having us on your show today, because this is a fantastic public outreach and opportunity for Greenfire. Another set of outreach that we're doing to what we call the phase two aspect of this is given reaching out to other organizations and collaborating with them, such as the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology, the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership, Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, formerly known as the Madison Audubon Society, the Wisconsin Sierra Club, the Wisconsin Wildlife Rehabilitators Association, and the Wisconsin DNR Wildlife Rehabilitation Advisory Council. Those are some of the organizations that we've reached out to form a collaboration to increase public education about this.
And, you know, just to clarify, if you're a hunter and you've accidentally shot one of those wild birds that you shouldn't have, what should you do?
Call the local warden first and foremost to let them know that this has occurred. Typically what will happen is that they meet, if they're available, they may meet you right on site. I guess my experience is that for the accidents, true accidents that happen, the legal system has shown quite a bit of leniency in terms of addressing those. But so that's what I would encourage is the reporting. It's no different than if a hunter makes a mistake, like say during the deer season, and they didn't have a doe permit. They thought they were shooting a buck, and it turns out not to be the case. You're always best to call the conservation warden right away. That's the best course of action.
Yeah, and you're likely, because you called and were cooperative, you're probably not going to be in much legal trouble, would be my guess anyway. Well, I did want to bring that up because that was one question somebody had on email. Somebody else, this one, Don in Cottage Grove, says they just recently had contact with a barn owl. I wonder if it's barn or maybe a barred owl. Barn owls aren't that many barn owls.
Very rare.
Very rare. But let's say it was a barred owl. It knocked itself out. What should you, what should your first response be upon discovering an injured large bird?
Thank you for that question. There is the Wisconsin DNR has a website as well. And if you go to that, they have also very good tabs on there. But contact the nearest wildlife rehabilitator, because those folks are the ones that have training and licenses to properly take care of the animal. It's easier if you contact the Wisconsin DNR via the website. I did want to mention, so thanks for bringing up the unethical shootings. The Wisconsin DNR has a tip line, which is 1-800-TIP-WDNR, and that you can call or email, I think, leave anonymously information about an animal or a bird that you've found that's been injured or shot.
We have, you know, we're talking birds here. We're in the middle of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin's Fat Bird Week. It's like Fat Bear Week, but for birds.
Right.
I went online, and you can vote. We're in the it's, you know, running like the NCAA basketball tournament. But the photos of these fat birds, and if you want to go out and see pictures of chunky birds, we've got that link on our website as well. Oh, man. So I want to go back again to the public now and how the public could be more involved with Wisconsin's Green Fire. Tom, let's go to you.
Well, I think the easiest thing is probably to go to our website, wigreenfire.org, and on your opening window, it'll have a tab that allows you to support the mission there. And so you can do it with a small donation and become a member. I think the other thing that we would appreciate is take a look at some of the informational materials that we have on our website and spread the word. There's just a lot of people that aren't up on some of the natural resources issues that we are facing here in Wisconsin. And so, again, word of mouth education, I think sometimes is the most persuasive way to pass information along.
Right, exactly. I would say that. And then also, the Green Fire is organized into different work groups. For example, Tom is the co-chair of the wildlife work group, and I am a member of that. But there's a number of other work groups. There's the Young Professionals Work Group, Young Conservation Professionals Work Group. There's the Public Lands Work Group. There's the Waters Work Group. So if you have a specific interest, you know, go ahead and contact the leader of that work group. Or if you just want to know more about everything, you know, you're more than welcome to peruse all the information on that website.
Well, I was really interesting to me, and of course, they can go online to find your the results, the more detail on the results of the study. We didn't get into everything for sure. And your phase two, you're ongoing with that right now, I'm suspecting?
We are hitting the ground running for phase two. We've just received encouraging support and recognition for phase one, and so it's a perfect segue into phase two. And a lot of that is just, you know, what we're doing right here, Larry. So thank you for this. Just public education and letting people know that this is something that Wisconsin's Green Fire is working on. So please support us.
Well, we'll have to have you back. Talk again. It was fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
Tom Haugie co-chairs Wisconsin's Green Fires Wildlife Work Group, part of the Science Advisory Council, and Carrie Behiller is a member of Wisconsin's Green Fire Science Advisory Council as well. And they know a lot, as you probably figured out as you listened to them talk. And we'll get them back, and we will kind of follow their string of work and successes. So thanks again. And we'll turn our attention to, we're staying with birds, but these are birds that you might have in your backyard, chickens. We'll talk about raising chickens in your backyard, or maybe if you've got a small farm, how to do that with our next guest, who's done it a whole lot. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. Have you heard that sound in your neighborhood? Or maybe you hear it every day in your own backyard. Oh, chickens. Sometimes the simplest pleasures are the best ones. You know, I've got a friend who raises chickens, and once in a while, she'll bring me some of those fresh eggs right from the coop. And you take one of those eggs or two of them, and I would never just take one. It's always a couple. Maybe you scramble them in a little bit of butter. I like them over easy myself. And that just pretty much tastes like heaven. I'm thinking, oh, Larry Mueller, we're covering the basics of keeping chickens in your backyard with our guest today, Kelsey Jorison Olesen, with us today. She's a first-generation female farmer, self-proclaimed crazy chicken lady, and sustainability advocate and educator at Green Willow Homestead in Shell Lake. And you might want to go to type in Green Willow Homestead, and her site, her husband's site pops up, and I think you'll have some fun going through what they have there at Shell Lake. And she's here to tell you how to start raising your own chickens, and she'll be answering your questions. And I'm wondering about your experiences, either raising them yourself or having them as neighbors. Maybe your neighbor is raising some. And maybe you have some suggestions about caring for them. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us. Email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Kelsey Jorison Olesen, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with me. I'm going to tell our listeners that we're talking, and I'm looking at you via Google Meet, if I'm not mistaken. And you may have there's an impending birth on your farm.
Yes, I've got a pregnant goat. Yep, I'm watching her on my maternity goat ward camera. thanks to modern day technology, I can see she's just walking around right now. But I think we're okay. I think we should be able to get through our segment today, Larry. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, if you have to run off, we'll somehow go on, we'll get on without you. But I'm hoping you can make it the whole way here.
Yes, me too.
Well, you're a first generation farmer, as I mentioned. How'd you get into farming?
So I have a bit of an eclectic background for someone who's gotten into chicken keeping and farming. Initially, I worked as a professional actor and filmmaker in Chicago for several years before my husband and I bought our first farm in Milwaukee. And I had always felt this pull towards getting my hands in the dirt, raising animals, growing my own food. My best friends were in 4-H growing up. I hung out on farms. It was just addictive to me. So I went very quickly from growing my own food to growing food for others, and have now been farming for almost a decade. So as you mentioned, my husband and I, we do currently live in Shell Lake, Wisconsin, and we are on 80 acres. We raise milking goats as well as sell eggs and flowers at our local farmers markets.
So why'd you pick Shell Lake?
Our family's here. Both my husband and my family's here. And when the pandemic hit, my husband and I looked at each other and said, we have no support here in Milwaukee. We want to have kids. We better get up close to those grandparents.
that's a very familiar sounding choice.
Yes.
that I've heard from many people. So what'd you learn in your first year of farming? I mean, there's that pastoral view, but then there's also sometimes reality steps in. I'm wondering what you learned.
You know, that's so true. I think that with social media, we can be bombarded with this romanticized version of what homesteading and farming can look like and feel like. But in reality, it's stinky, it's messy, it's dirty. You deal with death. You have to get your hands dirty. One of the things that really helped me step into becoming a farmer was operating on my own chicken. She had a what's called impacted crop, so her stomach had filled up with baling twine, and I brought her to a vet, and the vet said, look, either I can look at a YouTube video and do this, or you can look up a YouTube video and do this. But, you know, the difference is about $350, so you make the choice. And so I put on my medical gloves, and I operated on my chicken myself, and I kind of, from there, I've never looked back. I think I'm an honorary vet at this point.
Samantha in Whitehall wonders if, and you may or may not know this, where would you go to find out if you're allowed to have chickens in your backyard per your town's rules?
That's a great question. So the best resource for finding this information is your county clerk. If you call into their office and ask, they will be able to tell you the answer right away. You can also look up your municipal codes online at your city's municipal codes. So where we originally lived, outside of Milwaukee in Franklin, we were given sort of an acreage limit. So if you were on 3 or more or 5 or more acres, you were allowed to have X number of chickens. And then now I know in the city of Milwaukee, a lot has changed, and a lot of neighborhoods have been advocating to get chickens in their backyards.
Yeah, I go through my neighborhood in Madison, and there are a few. They always seem to be, and there are very few chickens. I'm not sure what Madison's rules are. It's either somewhere between 3 and 5 birds.
Right. Yep.
You're allowed to have, and so you can do it even in Madison, which sometimes gets a reputation for not being too good about rules like that. So what are the basic things you need to think about before you start raising chickens?
So for me, what I always like to tell people is if you can shadow somebody who already has chickens, that would be my first tip. Being able to actually see firsthand what chicken keeping is like is so informative and is going to help you understand if it's a good fit for you and your family. And from there, I would start with written resources. You can go to the library, you can get online. My blog, greenmillowhomestead.com, has tons of resources from how to hatch your own chicks in an incubator to how to build your first chicken coop. So I loved the library getting started. The library was my greatest resource, and I checked out every single book I could find. And then I also, as I mentioned, shadowed another chicken keeper to see if it was something that I would actually like.
Stella in Sturgeon Bay, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. We're currently on our third flock. We live in town, and our city, we checked with our city planner, and it happens that our city does not have any chicken ordinance, and they don't want to have a chicken ordinance because they figure that they can cover noise by noise ordinances, and they can cover smell by nuisance ordinances. And so there's no, within reason, we can have a flock of however many birds as long as we're not on a commercial scale. But what I was calling in about is because we have a summer pen for our girls that's way at the very back of our backyard, and then we have a winter pen that's up by the house, and that's between our house and our neighbor's house. And in order to not have it smell, for one reason, and for another, in order to get compost, in the fall, my husband collects all of the leaves off of our yard and off of one neighbor's yard and puts them in the winter pen so that the leaves end up being about mid-thigh deep on me at the start of the winter. And over the winter, we occasionally put out some straw on top of the leaves, but the chickens scratch it, and we throw all of our kitchen scraps out there, and the chickens scratch and dig around and poop. And, and we clean out the hen house into the pen, and they mix that in, and so it all gets mixed up over the winter. And then in the spring, we move them into their summer quarters, and then my husband cleans out all of that bedding, and we have a three bin composter in the back of the yard, and we compost that over the summer. And then in the fall, put it into pots and store them in the summer hen house over the winter.
Well, you've got quite an operation there, Stella. And Kelsey, it looks like you were nodding in agreement many times. You know what? Let's save this because we need to take a quick break here to look at the news. So we'll keep those thoughts in our head. And I know Kelsey Jorison Olesen's going to have something to say about our last caller's comments. And I hope you have some comments, too. You can reach us at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you with your thoughts, questions, suggestions, experiences. We're going to take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with our guest, Kelsey. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about raising backyard chickens with our guest, Kelsey Jorison Olesen. She's with us for the rest of the show. She's a first-generation farmer, self-proclaimed crazy chicken lady, and sustainability advocate and educator. And her and her husband's farm is Green Willow Homestead in Shell Lake, Wisconsin. I went online to the Green Willow Homestead website. It's a great site. You'll learn a lot, and you'll have some fun, too, as you read through it and look at the photos and so forth. So you raise chickens in your backyard or want to do it? Tell us about it. Love to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Kelsey, we heard from Stella from Sturgeon Bay just before the news break. She and her husband sound like they're doing a very good job raising chickens. Maybe you can comment on her story.
Yes, I love how Stella, first of all, talked about she has two separate coops. She has a summer coop and a winter coop. And in Wisconsin, that actually becomes really important. It is cold. You do not want to walk all the way across your yard through the snow to take care of your chickens. Her having a winter coop close to the house is just genius because you take a couple steps out the door, get your eggs, feed your chickens, check on them, and then you can go back inside and curl up. During the summer on our farm, what we like to do, we have our barn for the winter, but during the summer, we put our chickens in what's called a chicken tractor, and we push them across the grass. It is a mobile structure, and me, I weigh 135 pounds. I can push that thing all by myself. And each day, our chickens get a new patch of grass, and they go to town. They love the bugs. They love the grass. And then the other benefit of a mobile chicken tractor is that the poop doesn't collect in one spot. You get to move it over your lawn and slowly fertilize your lawn as you move that chicken tractor along. And if our listeners are curious, we actually sell the build plans to those chicken tractors right on our website. And at this point, I think we've had over 6,000 people build chicken tractors all around the world using our plans.
I love that A-frame concept. And it's on wheels.
Yes, it is so slick. It really keeps your yard looking nice. The poop doesn't kill the grass. So then that brings me to the second point that Stella made. She talked a lot about composting, which is one of the best benefits of keeping chickens is that free fertilizer. You can't say that about a cat or a dog.
Right.
you know, that goes right in the garbage. But with chickens, you can compost that. She used leaves right from her yard, which is really economical. We love to use sawdust. My husband works as a remodeler, so we have a lot of sawdust on hand. And we will sprinkle that sawdust over the poop, and it will keep the smell down, and it will help it compost. So we use that in our garden. We use that in our flower beds. I call it chicken gold. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So what kind of tending do chickens need?
So with chickens, you're going to want to think about first where they're going to live. Chickens need a quiet, secluded place to lay eggs and a safe, sheltered place to roost at night. Some ideas that I've seen is you can convert an old shed to turn it into a chicken coop. You can build a mobile chicken tractor, like I mentioned. There are so many options for creating a cozy space for your hens. And as long as they're able to be locked up at night and they have a nesting box to lay their eggs, you can't go wrong. When it comes to bedding, I like to lay down sawdust or pine shavings. And when it comes to the daily chores, they're going to need fresh water. They're going to need a scoop of feed, and they're going to need to be observed to make sure nobody's sick or injured. But other than that, they're pretty much no different than a cat or a dog, except you don't have to walk them. You don't have to put them. I know some people like to put their chickens on leashes, but it's not required.
And I want to go back to your A-frame because I love that construction idea because they roost kind of in the top of the A-frame.
Mm-hmm.
And then you, in the morning, that's when you move the roost on the the A-frame, or the tractor, as you call it, on.
Yeah.
And so they're already up in the roost, so you're...
Yeah. There is a roost area that is closed off from below, and there is a ramp that we have on a pulley system. So you lower that ramp, and the chickens can go up and down into that roost, which sits above the ground. And then at night, you pull that pulley system back up, and you tie off the ramp, and they are snug as a bug inside that roost. We have not lost a single chicken inside our chicken tractors, and it's been almost 7 years at this point that we've had them. So they really have a good security for those chickens at night.
And they're kind of attractive, too. The birds are attractive, but I mean, the A-frame is kind of attractive as well.
I appreciate that, Larry. Thank you. I have an eye for design, and my husband is an engineer. So together, we made what we thought looked best. And obviously, a lot of other people think it looks pretty great, too.
Yeah. We've got a number of email questions in here. Cease in southern Wisconsin emailed us. They'd like to hear about the extra sep. Their son in Montana had to take when beginning a chicken coop. Their son had to install an electric fence to keep the grizzly bears out.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know. Oh, my goodness. Every area has its own challenges when it comes to predators. You know, here in northern Wisconsin, we've got black bears. That's something that we deal with. And those electric fences come in really handy when you're dealing with the big predators like bears.
Yeah.
Another option, too, is we have what's called livestock guardian dogs, and they are trained to not hurt the chickens, but protect them. And they take care of things like eagles, coyotes, foxes, and bears.
Ari emailed us. They'd love to have chickens, but their homeowners association says chickens aren't allowed. Apparently, back in 2008, someone in the HOA had chickens and didn't handle the poo properly, so all the neighbors had to smell it. Any tips on convincing their HOA to change their mind?
Oh, I hear this story time and time again. It's always one person who can ruin it for the whole lot. And yeah, you do have to be conscious of manure management so it doesn't smell. And just like we have to be conscious with our other pets like cats and dogs, we clean up our dog's poop when we go for a walk. It should be no different when it comes to chickens. So I will say, when it comes to communities' concerns about chickens, it's usually the noise, it's disease, and it's poop. And when it comes to poop, I think that if you have the proper management, it's not going to smell. In my experience, like I said, we sprinkle sawdust over the poop to keep the smell down. And they also have something that's called PDZ, and it's azomite. And it actually absorbs the ammonia and neutralizes the nitrogen so that it speeds up the composting process and it neutralizes the smell. And PDZ is available in stores like Farm and Fleet, feed stores. You can have it ordered and shipped right to your house. And we go through a bag of PDZ probably every couple of months, and it comes in really handy. Now, of course, where we are, we don't have a lot of neighbors since we've got a big farm. But even me, I don't want to smell that. So I suggest using the PDZ. And then, too, when it comes to HOAs, you know, it can be hard when somebody's ruined it for the whole bunch. I would say do your research. If you can focus on electing people to your HOA's board who are more pro-chicken, that is another good step.
All good points. Carolyn in, I'm not sure where, she emailed us. Their daughter was in 4-H, raised chickens. 4-H leaders were a great resource of information and quality chickens over the years. They had two hens, an American named Miss Americana, and a leghorn named Louie the Leghorn, who lived to be 17 years old. And they believe their longevity was due to adding apple cider vinegar to their water every time they changed it, in addition to the loving care they gave them.
Absolutely. Apple cider vinegar is a fantastic holistic approach to keeping your chickens healthy. Another addition you can do when giving your chickens fresh water every day is to add a clove of crushed garlic. Garlic is very good antimicrobial and antibacterial. It's something that I do for my chickens on top of the apple cider vinegar.
And Lisa in East Troy emailed, they're thankful to live in the country. The chickens are like potato chips. You can't have just one, Lisa says. There's so many benefits. She says they have zero food waste in their home. They always have fresh eggs. They mentally fulfill Lisa, and they are entertaining. And they're smarter than people give them credit for. They've come when their name is called. Some like to cuddle, and they have their own personalities. They're inexpensive in regard to the rest of their farm animals. The worst part of having chickens is when they die. They truly become one of the family. And Lisa's recommending everybody try it. What are your thoughts on Lisa's comments?
Absolutely. I agree that chickens are a part of the family. And over time, you definitely create a sense of family. And sorry, my toddler's crawled into the room here.
I'm watching Carrie walk into the other room to find her toddler.
Yeah, we're a family farm here, as well as our chickens being part of the family. So
That's all right.
That's okay. My dad's here watching my son, so he's going to quick grab him. Okay, there we go. Crisis averted. It takes a village, Larry. So yes, to her point, the hardest part I have found is when chickens pass away, which was actually a huge reason as to why we created our own mobile chicken coop, because we let our chickens free range initially. And when they free range, you run into a lot of issues with predators, especially predators from above, like eagles and hawks and owls. So keeping chickens safe is probably the thing that's going to keep you up at night the most when you have your flock.
But if you have a decent pen.
Yep. If you have a decent pen, I used to call our original chicken coop Fort Knox, but even then we had a raccoon get in and take out half our flock in that first year. It was absolutely devastating. But you experience losses like that and you learn, Larry. Otherwise, you know, you'd throw in the towel and you wouldn't have those delicious eggs every morning.
Well, and again on that, I hate to keep coming back to your coop, but you spent a lot of time putting that information together for building the coop that you use, and it really is slick.
Thanks, Larry. We did. My husband and I have had, at this point, over 12 revisions to the plans, and that came from us using the build plans and using the chicken tractor over time, as well as our customers. We're really open to the feedback from people who have built our tractors and, you know, experienced things in different environments, different climates, experienced different predators. And we have taken all of that into account when it comes to trying to create the best mobile chicken tractor there is out there.
Which breeds are best?
That is such a great question. I was hoping you'd ask me about breeds. So first, I do want to say when it comes to chickens, you're going to want more than one because chickens are social creatures. Most city ordinances allow you to have three. So I say get those three chickens because they need each other. They're very social. When it comes to deciding what breed of chicken to go with, you're going to want to think about your climate first and foremost. Select breeds that do really well with high temperatures if you live in a hot area with mild winters. Here in Wisconsin, you are going to want chickens that are hardy in those cold, cold temperatures. So for us, we have had the best experience with what are called ISA Browns. Now, they're not the prettiest looking chickens. They're just your typical brown looking chicken. They lay brown eggs. But man, do they do well in the cold climate. They never are sick. They are so friendly, and they are one of the most productive egg layers in my experience. So I love those ISA Browns, and then I also love Wyandottes. Wyandottes are really, really pretty and also really sassy. They're kind of the divas of the chicken the chicken breed world.
Somebody else wondered about encouraging egg production. Are there tricks or tips for encouraging the chickens to lay their eggs?
Yeah, there are some tips and tricks to encourage egg production. So one of the things you will find is that chickens really slow down in the winter months because egg laying is determined by the amount of light that we have every day. So what people will do is oftentimes hang a light on a timer in their chicken coop so that their chickens get at least 12 to 16 hours of sunlight a day. And that will keep egg production up in the wintertime. For us personally, we choose not to do that to our chickens in the wintertime. We give them some time to rest. We don't have as many customers for eggs in the wintertime. So we let our chickens have a little vacation through those colder months. The other thing that you can do is be sure to offer your chickens a form of calcium, because calcium is what makes those eggshells nice and hard and strong. One way you can do that is by offering your chickens what are called oyster shells. Another thing, if you are looking to save money, is when you crack your eggs in the morning, save those chicken shells, chicken egg shells, crush them up and feed them right back to your chickens.
Why not?
Yep.
Recycle.
Free calcium. Recycle. Yeah.
Mark in Wisconsin Dells has something. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering how to keep your darn chickens out of my flower bed because they're throwing $1,000 worth of mulch onto the driveway every day. And how to keep them off my front porch. My little dog rolls in their crap and brings it in the house.
Well, you've got that problem solved, I believe, Kelsey.
Yep, we keep our chickens in that chicken tractor, and that keeps them from getting into the neighbor's yard. But you know what? As I mentioned, a free-range chicken, even though that's what they love and that's what they thrive on, there's a lot of consequences and downsides to that. So perimeter fencing is really important if you're going to free-range your chickens, because not only is it your neighbor's flower beds and their garden, but it's also the neighbor's dogs, you know, that it goes both ways because chickens are escape artists. So you got to keep those perimeters strong so chickens can't squeeze through and cause havoc. You know, the other thing I can say is that if you're a neighbor that doesn't want those chickens on your porch, just keep a hose with a nozzle handy. You can spray them and they will learn. Chickens are smart. They will learn, just like you keep a spray bottle on your counter to keep the cats off the counter.
You mentioned earlier, I think you said, I forget, it was a cup of feed or something, but somebody else is wondering, what's the best feed for chickens?
You know, we really like to stick to the organic feed. We pick that up at Tractor Supply in our area. You're going to want to make sure that the feed has at least a 18% protein ratio, because that'll help egg production stay up. And you're going to want to make sure that there is plenty of vitamins, minerals, and probiotics and prebiotics in that chicken feed, because that's going to keep their intestinal tracts healthy. So most chicken feed is formulated where you don't have to worry. You know, everything, all your bases are covered with chicken feed. Like I said, we like organic, but I understand that budget can come into play for a lot of people raising chickens. And the non-organic feed is definitely more affordable.
So the last show, just before you were on, I was the topic of avian influenza came up in terms of wild birds. Is this a common concern for poultry folks?
Absolutely. The avian flu is something that's on all of our minds. And this isn't just, you know, commercial flock owners. This is backyard chicken owners as well. The wild birds are a part of the problem when it comes to spreading this. And it's really hard to keep wild birds out of your barn. It's really hard to keep wild birds out of your feed. It's something that I live in fear of every day. And it's really hard to mitigate. Like I said, wild birds are pretty much the biggest culprit when it comes to it getting into your flock. We just had a caged feeding operation right down the road from us get entirely taken out by the avian flu. And we feel for that family. It's really rough. And I've also had people who sell eggs and are licensed be told that they have to cease and desist because of the avian flu risks in the area, and they don't want it being spread. We luckily have not been notified yet, but it's something that, like I said, it sits on my heart, and it definitely is a cause of concern for me.
Is that, and that's probably the primary disease, anything else in the way of disease that typically might come up?
So chickens, usually the biggest issues are respiratory issues, and you will see those crop up in the fall and spring, because that's when things are damp and moist and can be a bit chilly. When it comes to keeping your chicken's respiratory system healthy, that's basically a proactive approach. You're going to want to keep the bedding in their coop dry and free from ammonia. Ammonia really is, it's what comes from the chicken poop. It's what makes it smell. Ammonia is very hard on chickens' respiratory system. It's caustic. It burns their respiratory system. So keeping that bedding clean is really important, like sprinkling on the sawdust, adding more pine shavings or straw, adding that PDZ that I mentioned. Also, observing your chickens is one of the best ways to catch something quickly and isolate a sick chicken before it can spread to the whole flock. Keep a dog crate on hand and some puppy pads and put that chicken aside and bring her in the house if you need to. I've done that before to make sure a chicken stays healthy. And, you know, the internet is, there is no loss of information when it comes to caring for a sick chicken. There are Facebook groups, there are forums, there are people who are willing to help you problem solve and look at symptoms and give you recommendations when it comes to keeping your chickens healthy.
You know, just to wind up, I mentioned earlier, I went to your Green Willow Homestead website, which I find great. You've got a blog.
Thank you.
You got a blog. You got a, and you're selling some tinctures and.
Yes. Yep. We like to make tinctures from things that we grow on our farm and forage on our farm. One of the things that we love to do is make cocktail bitters.
Well, yep. Of course, all of that is available on your Green Willow Homestead site. Kelsey, it's been a lot of fun. I hope we can do this again down the road sometime. Thank you so much for being with us.
I hope so too, Larry. Thanks so much for having me on.
Kelsey Jorissen Olesen, our guest, first generation female farmer, and man, she knows a lot, doesn't she? It was great. She calls herself the crazy chicken lady, and she's not crazy when it comes to raising chickens. That's for sure. She's also a sustainability advocate and educator at Green Willow Homestead in Shell Lake. Well, that was fun. Thank you so much for listening in today. What do we got tomorrow on the show? We're going to hear about a couple's road to success on a tandem bike, and then the basics of bicycle maintenance with the owner of a Lake Mills bicycle shop. That's tomorrow at 11 on The Larry Mueller Show. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller.